Once upon a time, there was a little grey man who thought he could tell stories. But every time he started one, he found it almost impossible to finish the first sentence, not because he couldn't keep talking, but because he couldn't bear to stop long enough to make the sort of pause which is equivalent, when nothing's being written down, to a full stop, and found it hard to achieve as much of a climax as he thought the sentence needed before it was entitled to finish. And this was because each time he was approaching something that might provide a climax, he thought it was necessary before he got there to introduce a digression which couldn't be postponed until he'd started a new sentence, and this was a pity because sometimes there was just not enough breath in his lungs to be able to...
Such Rotten Luck, The Ups and Downs of a Second-Class Writer by Ronald Heyman, with Tim Pigott-Smith as Woodhouse, Zoe Wanamaker as Gila, and Stephen Ray as Seamus. First Hump, The Little Grey Man.
I don't believe you.
What?
That all my ideas are bad.
Woodhouse, did I say all your ideas are bad?
No. So long as some of them are okay, that's what matters. It's like with your music. If every bar was brilliant, I mean, well, we just couldn't work together. I wouldn't want to collaborate with a genius. It'd be demoralising. Anyway, listen, I'm going to read you the next one. There was a young prankster called Muriel who basted her turkeys with lard. Her favourite county was Lancashire, and she didn't believe in God. What do you think, James?
I don't see the point.
But that's right.
What is?
The point is there's no point. Do you want another pint?
Okay, then.
Hey, there's something in that. Hang on. Did you hear the one about the Irishman in the pub? He said, "I don't see the point." And the bartender said, "It's right there in front of you, and if you don't see it, I'm not serving you." Do you think it'd be better if the barman said, "If you don't see it, you've had enough"? Oh, never mind. I think I want to start a new movement called the New Pointlessness.
You want me to be honest?
Two more, please. Bitter, of course.
Isn't that rather old hat?
Not at all. Most poems and most songs still have a point. That's what's old hat. Most poems are so bloody chock full of messages, no better than propaganda.
Propaganda for what?
For the assumption that life has a point. Pointless poetry faces up truthfully to the harsh reality of contemporary aimlessness. I don't think mankind has developed enough spiritual strength to confront the depressing fact that reality is as pointless as my writing. Would you like to hear another?
Do you want me to be honest?
£1.80.
Oh, right. Here you go. An atheist plumber from Eastbourne used to mash up his spuds with a trowel. His grandmother's nickname was Bunny, and they lived in Chipping Sodbury.
But that's absolute nonsense.
Yes! You know, I had a feeling it might work as a lyric for one of your Auntie Schubert songs. Can you hear those words over a piano accompaniment that jingles away just as if the world was still full of roses that argue with you before they prick your finger, and trout that swim around in quintets?
You're 20p.
Oh, thanks. Shall we go back to your place and work with your synthesizer?
Wow.
What?
That blonde in the green dress.
I'll have to wait till she turns around. What's her face like?
I don't know, but if God put it on the same body as that bum, you can be sure he knew what he was doing.
You know what you should do?
Go over and grab it from behind. I don't know. You always say I'm too primitive. What should I do?
Read some more W.B. Yeats.
How would that help?
For an Irishman, you're horribly inarticulate about female beauty. I'm back.
Hello, Woodhouse. Guess what? Mm-hmm. We've got a cleaner.
A cleaner? But, darling, you said you didn't mind doing it yourself.
She only costs 69p an hour.
That's impossible.
Wait till you meet her. Wilhelmina? Bill?
Oh, gosh, sorry. Sorry, have you been there a long time?
I want you to meet my husband, Woodhouse Carton. This is Wilhelmina.
Hello, Wilhelmina.
Hi. Why don't you call me Bill? Everybody else does.
How do you do? Bill, I believe you're going to work for us.
Well, I've made a start. This carpet is filthy.
Sorry. Are you sure...
Yeah. Everybody says that. I charge 69p to make it sound as though it's carefully worked out, which it is. But I don't need money. I let people pay me for their sake, not mine.
But if you don't mind my asking...
If I don't need money, why am I doing it? Mrs. Carton asked the same question.
Call me Gila.
I'm doing it for the experience.
She's a writer.
What a coincidence. I'm a writer too. Might be able to give you the odd tip.
I don't accept tips.
I didn't mean money.
I know, you meant advice. Anyone with intelligence would see I never take advice. Would I be doing this sort of work if I did?
I said to my mind, shut up and let the dark come upon you, which shall be the dark enlightenment, like on the telly, when the screen goes grey till the commercial flickers on and gaudy colours adumbrate the grey, or like an underground train that stops too long between Euston and King's Cross, and the stench of evening bores the buttocks off the standing passengers. I said to my mind, shut up, and wait without thought. For thought would be thought of the wrong thing. Wait without love. For love would be love of the wrong bird. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the thought are in the writing. Wait without writing, for you are not yet ready to write. You must go by a way wherein there are no royalties. In order to become what you are not, you must go by the way of being no one special. In order to achieve great fame, you must go on being unknown. You will write only what others have already written, and what readers would most have liked will be what you just crossed out.
Your mother's quite right.
But, Daddy, I've said that to him 1,000 times. He just doesn't listen.
A wife has ways of making her husband listen. Isn't that true, dear?
Did you say something, dear?
Either he's got talent, in which case he must prove it, or he hasn't, in which case he must give up and do something useful. If he wants to go into industry, your father could have a word with Witherspoon, couldn't you, darling?
What's that, my angel?
He thinks he's going to make his name with a biography.
Oh, why doesn't he make his name first and write his biography afterwards? No one wants to read about him if they've never heard of him.
It's not an autobiography, Daddy. It's a biography of Wolf Heinrich Grabart.
Who?
Grabart.
Oh, never heard of him. Why doesn't he do someone like Churchill? People have heard of him.
I think a book on Grabart might do quite well. When will it be out?
He's nearly finished the first draft, and next month we're going to Berlin.
Oh, the ugliest city in Europe. Why don't you go to Venice? Oh, it's terrible Pong, of course. It was beautiful in early spring before the Huns arrive. We spend our honeymoon there. Remember the Easter parade?
Yeah, it was Lisbon.
Oh, yes, that's right, Capri.
We aren't going on holiday. We're going to Berlin so Woodhouse can interview people who knew Grabart.
By the way, Professor, who should I see in Berlin?
You will not, of course, have sufficient time to meet his former mistresses unless you stay several months. Nor would there be point in doing so. The majority of these egregious ladies is perhaps mindless or inarticulate. This headstrong vulgarity you find in the more obscene of his sonnets reflects a lamentable taste in women. On the other hand, one of these past mistresses is in some ways more important than the wife, or, so to speak, widow. I mean, of course, Hildegard Blinkhorn.
Uh-huh.
I have met neither lady. My interest being naturally in the work, not the life.
but don't you think that in the case of a man like
Grabart... And please don't bore me with this tedious old argument that in the case of a man like Grabart, the two are not separate.
That's just what I was going to say, that they're totally separate. Which area of his writing interests you most?
Which of my books have you read?
Both of them, of course.
There are three... Not counting my essay in the collection collected to celebrate the death of Professor Knoblauch.
No, well, you write about Grabart with an insight that's... Well, it's extremely helpful to someone like me, who was still in his nappies when his form of anti-existentialism became so popular among German students.
You have been wearing Grabart's nappies?
No, I meant... I was too young in the late 40s to take an intelligent interest in Grabart's reaction to Sartre.
I, of course, understood what you meant.
Oh,
I merely wish to demonstrate that you, as a Negro, no, I mean native, should be speaking the language even better than I do, but you were perpetrating ambiguity when you said who was still in his nappies. Whose nappies?
I'm sorry. I mean, thank you for demonstrating it. You know. what do you think of his short story, The Childhood of a Left-Handed Priest?
It is, of course, of all his short stories, the greatest, propounding his anti-Sartrean conviction that life cannot be governed by human intentions. I have written most interestingly about this in my chapter on dominant and recessive modalities in my important book, Modality and Monumentality, a reconsideration of the narrative work of Wolf Heinrich Grauber.
Yes, I must read that chapter. No, I mean, reread it. Okay, come on, let's do some work on the song. I'll sing it to you, shall I?
I suppose there's no other way.
I do wish you wouldn't go on so much about my voice. You couldn't exactly earn a living as a singer yourself.
But I do sing in tune. I have absolute pitch.
Well, you're a professional bloody musician. Except the word professional implies you make a living out of it.
Shall we be having an argument about whether you're a professional bloody writer? Or shall we start working on the song? Please, give me the pleasure of singing it to me.
Thank you. Oh, I can only do what I can do. I can only do what I can do. I can only do what I can do. This is the chorus. Do, can do, can do, can do. I can only do what I can do. Second chorus. I can, 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 I can only do what I can do. Okay, second verse coming up. You can only do what you can do. Yes, you can only do what you can do. You can only do what you can do. Can do,
I think
can do, can
I've
do.
Got the general idea.
Well, what do you think?
I think it has possibilities if I can find the right melody for it.
What do you mean, find the right melody? Haven't I just given you a melody?
Well, I suppose you could call it that. It's a bit crude, of course.
My God, how wonderful! That's exactly what Kurt Weill said. Was it Hans Eisler? When Brecht sang in the melody they used for Mother Courage's song. If you and I can work together like Brecht and Kurt Weill, then we've really got it made.
How do you like that?
Well, quite apart from being arrogantly different and not nearly so tuneful as the melody I've just given you, it doesn't fit the words.
It doesn't have to. That's the intro. You can only do what you can do. Oh, you can only do what you can do. Hey, you can only do what you can do, can do, can do. You can only do what you can do.
Right, now we.
We can only do what we can do. Oh, we can only do what we can do. We can only do what we can do, can do, can do. It's true. We can only do what we can do.
Clack of high heels as two girls come in just before the doors close. They glance curiously round at a spectacled, ginger-haired man talking into a microphone, and then look at each other with what isn't quite a giggle. Well, now it is, yes, because they heard what I said. There's no better situation for feeling the counterpull of both tides. The outside world rubbing itself up against me with its oppressive noises and smells and unloving glances, and me stoically doing my literary thing, observing and recording and weathering the silent accusation they all make that I'm doing something slightly indecent by writing in public. Not sitting quietly in a left bank cafe like Jean-Paul Sartre, but speaking audibly into a machine. Yes, I like watching their different ways of sitting and moving and continuing their endless discourse with their idea of how attractive they are. There's also a bigger hopefulness or hopelessness, which I have too, but I have something else, a duty and a burden, a need to comment on these people. Most of them are pretending to ignore me as my voice goes on, courageously telling the truth about what I feel and about the incorrigible otherness of other people. Little Dorrit was deeply anxious that he should lie down to compose himself. On Arthur speaking to her of his going to inform Panks that he might now appear as soon as he would and pursue the joyful business to its close, she entreated him in a whisper to stay with her until her father should be quite calm and at rest. He needed no second entreaty, and she prepared her father's bed and begged him to lie down. For another half hour, he would be persuaded to do nothing but...
Isn't it for another half hour or more?
What? Oh, good Lord. Yes. I'm sorry. For another half hour or more, he would be persuaded to do nothing but go about the room, discussing with himself the probabilities for and against the marshals allowing the whole of the prisoners to go to the windows of the official residence. Don't tell me you know the whole of Little Dorrit by heart.
I wouldn't bet much money on myself with Martin Chuzzlewit, but I'm pretty good on most of Dickens.
But that's incredible. I mean, if you went blind... forgive me. If you went sightless, became unsighted?
Say went your... blind.
Oh, thank you. If you went blind when you were 23, that means you didn't have many years.
Well, I didn't start learning them till I was blind. It's a challenge like I've made to myself. Mm. I want to get the whole of Dickens off by heart before I pass away. God. I've done it just from listening to people reading. And cassettes. There's lots of readings on cassette these days. But I don't like actors. I don't like people much either. But people aren't so bad as actors. Are you an actor?
Good heavens, no. I'm a writer. My name is Woodhouse Carton.
Some actors volunteer to come along and read to us. Wasting bloody time, if you ask me. The buggers sound just the same on cassette. Only difference is you can't interrupt them if they make mistakes. Why are you doing it?
Well, I want to be altruistic at least half an hour each day. And the other motive is, I have this idea for a radio programme. And blindness is such a cliché on radio drama. I want the BBC to commission a documentary programme about it. And what I'm doing is reading to various old blind men, women too, and asking what it feels like to be blind. Oh. By the way, what does it feel like?
Not much use talking to folks if you don't record what they say.
Ah, but I do. You see, the thing about blind people is they can't see the cassette recorder.
You haven't got one on now, have
well,
you?
Well, I have, as a matter of fact. Well, you don't mind, do you?
You mean my voice might be on the radio one day? Is it big or small?
Or your voice? Well, you sound like a small man.
No.
The recorder. Yes. It's very small.
Oh.
I suppose they were still using those clumsy big tape recorders when you became... went blind.
How small are the newfangled things, then?
Well, they're no bigger than a small book. Would you like to see?
Well, yes, I would. It's not much fun being blind.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant, would you like to feel?
Oh, I don't want to make you unplug it.
No, it's not plugged in. It runs on batteries.
Oh.
Here.
Oh, it is small, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so light, too. Hey,
careful. You blind bugger. Okay, ladies and gents, can we get started, please? Right, first of all, what about the exercise I set you last week?
I weren't here last week.
Oh, well, I asked everyone to take either a well-known nonsense poem or alternatively the limerick form and use it as a point of departure.
Oh.
Good writing is always a matter of moving away from what's already there. So, who wants to go first?
Oh, I do.
Well,
the
thing is that...
Okay, Mrs. Sossman. Sissy, read out what you've written, please.
This is called Liest Liebestraum by Sissy Sotkin.
Do we really have to have elitist cultural references and everything?
Well, no, what I think we should do is wait and see if the cultural reference is organic or not. And what's really important is to start off with an open mind about other people's writing.
Let's give it a chance, Mr. McVomitry. Dermot. Hamish, I'm sorry. Before we pronounce judgment. Go ahead, sister.
Yes, but at least we can...
No, we'll hear the poem first and talk afterwards. Sissy.
This is called List Liebestraum by Sissy Thothkins. A painter called Cicely Pith told her brother, please give me a kiss. As his lips touch her skin, they saw visions of sin. The neckline is missing, but the moral is kissing such fun that you don't kiss your kin.
That's extremely interesting, Sissy. What are people's reactions?
I must say, I find the subject matter extremely offensive. Do we absolutely have to go along with the modern trend of introducing violence or sex into absolutely everything?
The point, surely, is that it isn't a sex, it's perverted sex.
I wonder whether anyone else has noticed. It's also a total cheat. This is a poem, if the word poem isn't paying it too much of a compliment. A poem which depends totally on what is, not to put too fine a point on it, the speech disability of the author of If.
Yeah. No.
Without a lisp, it wouldn't work. If I tried to recite it would go, I can't remember the exact words because they're so unmemorable, but it would go something like this. A painter calls Cicely Pliss, told her brother, please give me a kiss. As his lips touched her skin, they saw visions of sin and so on.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing. Well, everything. But the punchline about kiss and king wouldn't work.
Yes, but the real question is...
say that I'm totally aware of the somewhat tiresome point that Mrs. Masterson is making, so clumsily. You advise that a writer, like a dancer, should make his or her personal limitations into advantages. And that's precisely what I do.
Well, I think that's a fair comment. Anyway, let's go on to the next piece of writing, shall we? And then whatever discussion we want to have can take in more than one example. Who's done a variant on a nonsense poem? Mrs. Masterson. Harriet, let's have yours.
"'Twas boiling in the Lytton Groves, did jive and gamble in Park Lane. All clumsy were the folk from Hove and the Home Guard insane. Beware the juggernaut, my man, the wheels that crush, the noise that hurts. Beware the Hare Krishna lads, and shun such girls as still wear miniskirts. Mm. He took his green harpoon in hand. Long time the Buddhist hoard he sought. He took a bus along the Strand, without a ticket, but was caught. And while he argued with the police, the juggernaut did come along, and in a deep and ugly voice it sang this little song. 'Twas boiling, and the Lytton Groves did jive and gamble in Park Lane. All clumsy were the folk from Hove, and the Home Guard insane," and so on and so on. I wanted to write something that would go on forever. The idea is that when you get to the end, you start all over again, and the next time you get to the end, you can start...
I've taken your point. That's an excellent image of hell.
My poem? Is that how you interpret it?
No, the idea of listening to a poem by you that goes on forever.
Mr. Carton, Woodhouse, I do wish you'd tell this tiresome person that he can say whatever he wants to say without being quite so offensive.
Isn't that typical of the innate contradictoriness of the female mind? What this woman just said is, I can say whatever I want to say as long as I don't say it the way I want to. What we have here, ladies and gentlemen, is a would-be writer, a would-be poet, in fact, who still believes that what you say can be exactly the same if you use different words.
By all means, let's discuss the relationship between matter and manner, substance and style. But I think we'll all get more out of it if we link the discussion to the poems we're hearing,
yes,
rather than to remarks which aren't critical or rather aren't literary criticism. Mm-hmm. Now,
great.
Who'd like to read another poem?
Oh, well,
I did another.
Well,
I
would
like to hear another stanza.
I'll go on if you really think it helps you.
Oh, darling, of course it does. It's so much easier for me to imagine what happened if we do it together. They loved each other. It was the greatest relationship of his life. According to Professor Trinkelkopf, this woman was more important than his wife. Well, obviously I can think about it by myself, but the most exciting thing of all about this approach to biography is that it's dramatic and, well, improvisational, which means...
Okay. Let's get on with it.
Me telling... When you look at me like this, I'll sort of walk
finishes. Why did they talk in English?
Well, they didn't. But your German isn't good enough to improvise in. Well, neither's mine, for that matter. Well, it's better than yours is, but
I know your German is better than mine is. But if we have to do this, can we please do it without that idiotic accent? Unless they both had an atrocious English accent when they spoke German, did they?
No, of course they didn't.
They spoke ordinary German?
Yes.
Then for God's sakes, let's speak ordinary English.
You're absolutely right. I know. Let's do the bit about going on holiday together. He takes her to Aix-en-Provence, but when he gets her there, all he wants to do is write. She has to go for walks by herself and read and wait for the next meal. And OK?
I do think you might take some responsibility for entertaining me. I mean, for God's sake, this is supposed to be a holiday, isn't it? OK, you want to get the bloody story written.
Oh, sorry, but he's working on Die Zerbrochene Diana.
What's that?
The Broken Prostitute.
But what is it?
A novel. Okay.
You want to get your bloody novel finished. But you're famous for your powers of imaginative penetration. Can't you make a stab at guessing what it feels like to be me sitting around in this bloody boring place without speaking a word of the language?
Her French is better than his. And while we've stopped, could I ask you not to be quite so rude to him? You sound too much like you talking to me. I don't necessarily mean she loved him or respected him any more than you love and respect me, but they belonged, don't forget, to a different generation, and people then were basically, well, politer.
Let's do this some other time, shall we?
OK. What do you feel like doing now?
I think I'll go to bed.
Well, I suppose I don't need to do any more work tonight, really.
You know perfectly well that's not what I meant. Would I have said, I think I'll go to bed, if I meant that?
OK, maybe I should do some more work. Is that better?
I'm sorry, Woodhouse. I just don't feel like it tonight. I know you were trying to turn me on by involving me in your writing, but it doesn't work, does it?
It didn't work then. Doesn't mean to say it can't ever work.
But how can it? Whenever we try to write poetry together or collaborate on a translation or improvise a relationship, you're always the expert. Don't you see that? If I try to improvise without knowing the facts, I'm bound to make mistakes, which means you have to keep correcting me, which means you're always in the superior position.
Well, that doesn't matter to me. Why should it matter to you?
Because I don't like being bloody patronised. Sorry, Woodhouse. That was unreasonable.
Well, it was, rather.
Forgive.
I don't really want to do any more work, you know.
Why not do just half an hour and come to bed at 10 o'clock?
You promise not to be asleep.
If I am, I promise not to mind if you wake me up.
And when the little grey man arrived at the palace, the Lord Chamberlain said, I'm terribly sorry, little sir, but the princess isn't receiving. And the little man said, but please, I do so want to speak with her. And the chamberlain said, I'm sorry, little sir, but I'm under strict orders not to open Her Royal Highness's door to anyone in the whole wide world. And the little man said, if you can't open the door, can I speak to her very quietly through the keyhole? In fact, I might even whisper. And when the Lord Chamberlain said he thought that might possibly be in order, the little man, pitching his voice barely above a whisper, said, Your beautiful highness, I do so desperately need to see you because I've had such rotten luck all day long. When I tried to be polite to a foreigner, he said I couldn't speak English as well as he could. And when I tried to help people to write poetry, they kept quarrelling. And when I tried to help a blind beggar across the road, he hit me over the head with his white stick. And when I arrived at the palace, the Lord Chamberlain said you were very tired. But he let me come as far as this closed door, and then I tapped. Knock, knock. Very, very softly. And you said,
come in.
In The Little Grey Man, the first hump of such rotten luck, the ups and downs of a second-class writer by Ronald Heyman, Tim Pigott-Smith was Woodhouse, Zoe Wanamaker, Gila, and Stephen Ray, Seamus. Susie Brann was with